The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, everyone, so we're going to get started. I'd like to welcome everyone to the panel, Community-Driven Media for Social Change. We're glad so many people came out to hear from these great panelists. These are great community activists who are making their voices heard. We have a variety of experiences and media represented here. So I'd like to start just by framing the issue. Everyone in the audience has issues that they care about. And some people, they identify themselves with organizations or they donate time or money. Another way that you can get involved is by raising the profile of the issues that you care about most. And social change activists express themselves in a variety of ways. And community-driven media, whether it's blogging, radio, print, anything like that, it's fast becoming the medium of choice. Hear from activists who are creating, changing, or contributing to the movement through the use of community-driven media. We hope that the session can help you map out how you can use community media as part of your activism, from deciding which medium you'd like to use or how to create a process that works for you. We hope this will help you navigate your path to a community-driven media of your own. So let me introduce you to the panel first. I'm actually going to go kind of a lot of order. First, we're going to start with Silky Shah. She co-produces Asia Pacific Forum. It's a progressive pan-Asian radio show that is broadcast on Tuesdays at 8 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. She also currently works at the Detention Watch Network as an organizing and outreach coordinator. Next, we have Mariam Saifi. Mariam is a freelance writer and currently serves in the editorial collective of Summer, South Asian magazine for action and reflection. Summer aims to foster serious debates within the South Asian community and is fundamentally committed to advancing the forces of social and economic justice. Next in line, we have Abhi Tripathi at the end of the line there. Abhi is a blogger at CPM Mutiny, a cultural interest blog. CPM Mutiny's home is www.cpmmutiny.com. Finally, we have Tina Baga-Yakota. Tina is a co-host and co-producer of Radiothon that is broadcast on 88.7 WLUW Chicago. Radiothon features interviews, music, and discussions around topics like brotherhood and the diasporic experience. Tina has also been trained in documentary videography and has screened her work in festivals across the U.S. Tina is also a member of the South Asian Progressive Action Collective. We're going to start this session off by hearing from each of the panelists. Then we're going to delve a little deeper into the different mediums of expression that are represented and end with a question and answer session with the audience. Really quickly, I just want to remind everyone to turn off their cell phones. By way of introduction, can each of you tell us what motivated you to get started in the work that you do on your blog, magazine, or radio show? Are there values or principles that motivated you, or recognition of a void, or something in particular? Mariam, would you like to start?
Sure. So I got involved with Samar probably like maybe 5 years ago, first as a writer. It was one of the first sort of open spaces where there was a dialogue about, you know, a range of issues in the South Asian community, and I was particularly interested at that point on post-9/11 immigrant backlash and then the rise of Islamophobia. It was a year or so after 9/11, and so I started out just writing for a piece, like a book review on this book by a Canadian talk show host, Irshad Munji, which I completely disagreed with, and it was a good sort of venting modicum. And later, I just got involved about a year later into, you know, the editorial side of things. And so it just kind of, it was for me, I got involved more because I felt like it was a platform for a diverse set of voices to be heard and debates to be sort of fostered within the South Asian community and the diaspora as well.
So I guess in terms of, you know, I was a journalism student. I'm from Texas, at the University of Texas at Austin. And it was, you know, I ended up doing a community radio show on, like, Asian American community radio show called the Chutney Bubble Tea Half Hour, which was really great. But we did it, I remember I was like a junior, and I was kind of figuring out, I was like a journalism student figuring out, like, what medium made the most sense for me. And you know, I had a friend who, and I had actually was familiar with Asia Pacific Forum because it's been around for a long time. And I had a friend who was just like, "You want to do this radio show with me?" I was like, "Sure, whatever." And we ended up, like, our first show was the Tuesday after 9/11. So it really, you know, like a lot of things started coming up, and I realized I just really loved doing interviews. I really loved exposing these stories, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. And so I continue to do radio in different ways. And then when I moved to New York, I was like, awesome, I can really do this on a radio station. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, with the radio show, I basically was sitting around one day, and my co-host and co-producer, Sameep, just called me up and asked me if I wanted to join him. And it happened to be a kind of childhood dream of mine to do radio. With video, I was at UCLA, and they have a program called Ethnocommunications, where they try to teach techniques, documentary techniques to students to go out there and tell stories that would never be told otherwise. So I was trained at UCLA and at an organization called Visual Communications in Los Angeles, which is another API media organization.
Thanks, Tina.
Okay, so for me, I should actually start by saying I don't think I sent my biography in time, and that's okay. I'm not trying to, I don't want to take time to tell people my biography except for the fact that it's relevant. Okay, so I actually got started with CP Muni when I was a grad student at UCLA as well, but my background is not in journalism or anything. My bachelor's degree was in aerospace engineering, and my doctorate's actually micropaleontology, okay? So it's not at all associated with any of this. So, but I found that I was interested in a lot of things that I was hearing in the emails that my friends sent, you know, like really interesting causes that I was thinking to myself, why don't more people know about this? You know, and some of my friends that were on those email lists are sitting in the audience here, which is kind of funny. But when I started the blog as an idea, we thought, okay, there's got to be a better way, because I'm certainly not learning what I need to learn from what at the time was cultural newspapers like, you know, Rediff or India Abroad. I just wasn't seeing it. And it was about the time of the 2004 Democratic National Convention, and I wasn't hearing anything that interested me from the sense of the perspective of our community. And so sitting there bored in my lab one day, you know, I started emailing other folks who were bloggers and say, hey, you want to get together and, you know, start something that we'd be able to serve the community, a larger community with. So that's how I got started.
That's great. I want to pose actually just another question to all of the panel before we delve a little bit deeper. What guides the stories that you write about or make issues around or put radio shows, structure them around? What factors do you consider when you do something? And Abhi, if you'd like to start.
Okay, so for me, I think a similar question came up in the journalism panel, which was in the session before. And for me, it's like when there's a story that you want to write, you just know it. Okay, and the way that I'm able to distinguish of, you know, we get in a lot of tips a lot of times, but I actually don't really use a lot of the tips that come in, which I think I noticed was in contrast to what I was hearing in the journalism panel, and that surprised me. You know, they get a lot of people, send them press releases, a lot of people, you know, contact them, hey, come to our event, and this is what we want you to talk about. Whereas I actually spend the vast majority of my time in coming up with stories, searching them out, you know, going out there, doing my own research. Oh, what have I heard about? Oh, is this person that's involved in this, you know, doing this now? And so really, the thing that drives me to write something is the action. Okay, so you could be an organization and you could say, hey, you know, we're this organization based in New York and we do this, this, and this for this community. Okay, and that's great. You know, that's, I'm so glad someone's doing this, that, and that. But if you send me instead you send me an email or a story saying, hey, we're this organization in New York, and oh, by the way, we did this, you know, we stood up for this person or we helped this person stop them from getting deported or whatever it is, that's action, you know, and it's much easier for me to write about and be passionate about action, because the one thing I will never do is write about something I don't know about. So you could have the best cause in the world, but every story, it's like, it's almost like a mob. It's someone like, you know, when you bring someone into the mob, you vouch for them. And if they're a mole or undercover, right, you get shot too. So for me, I won't ever write about a story that I don't, to some level, know about or can understand. I'm not just going to say, hey, this is a good story, I'm going to put it up.
Thank you. Tina?
I don't know if Sameep and I feel constrained by the parameters of most journalists, because neither of us are journalists either, just like you, Abby. So we see ourselves more as storytellers, and I feel like, especially with the folks from Drum, I feel like with activism, it comes from the heart, and when you can reach people at their hearts, they'll get interested in other stuff. They'll want to join something. So we're maybe not as overtly activist as some of my peers here. We try to get people at a more cultural level, even entertainment level, and we feel like that can open doors as well.
Well, just to describe Asia Pacific Forum, which is definitely, I mean, it's funny because we try to be, you know, we're really excited about what we do, but we are a little bit more structured. And the way it works is we have a collective which varies from 5 to 8 people, or has varied since the time I've been there, which is about 1.5 years. And it's been around since 1999. So it's been, WBAI has, like, carved, like, a niche for, like, okay, Asia Pacific Forum, this is the Asian American community show. So the way we do it, I mean, we've really structured it, which I think we are kind of talking about a little bit more, like how, you know, we don't need to stay within these parameters all the time. But we usually have 3 segments that are about 15 minutes each for the whole hour. And the segments are like news related to politics, cultural affairs, but also arts and culture. So, you know, we'll do something about military spending in Asia Pacific area, or something about, you know, the guest workers, which we'll hear about later, something, you know, something like related to what's going on in the news. But we really try to cover a story. I mean, we have like a monthly meeting where we just like sit down and we're like, okay, let's throw out all the story ideas you have for this month and let's go and let's see, you know, and then we'll just pick the days that we're doing it, and we usually have a co-host, so it's 2 people doing the show. And we try to think of stories that are either underrepresented, things that just aren't being represented in the media related to Asia and Asian America, or just ways that we can look at things through a different lens. So one example, which is a very cheesy example, but is when Harold and Kumar came out last year, and it was this whole, like, Harold and Kumar escaped from Guantanamo Bay, and we're like, okay, why is it easy to do this from Guantanamo? Why is it not easy to do this from, like, Abu Ghraib, where, you know, we saw the images. Guantanamo is this, like, very secretive place. So we actually interviewed the like cast and the directors, and we posed at them this question about, like, what, you know, what do you think about what's happening in Guantanamo? How do you think this plays in the film? And so I think, you know, while it was really like, okay, this new movie's coming out and everybody who's South Asian is talking, South Asian, Asian American in general, and that, you know, connection is talking about it, like, what more can we get out of it? And so that's kind of where we're coming from with that cultural piece, at least.
I think Samara is similar in a sense. It's a collective that's volunteer based, and we meet about once a month. There's 4 or 5 of us, and in terms of structure, we're sort of struggling with continuity, and because part of the way that we're structured is, on the one hand, we're reactive. So, for example, with the Bombay blast, we wanted to put out an issue right away, and we're not a blog, so we don't have the luxury of being able to. We have to go through an editing process and, you know, liaise with the writer. So on that sense, so we're reactive on one hand, but we also try to be thematic and look at underrepresented issues. For example, we had a piece on migration in general, and it looked at migrant workers in the Gulf, South Asian migrant workers in the UAE, for example, Indian migrants to East Africa, and we look at not just nonfiction pieces, but fiction pieces. So it's sort of a diverse way of looking at a lot of different issues. It's a way of just sparking conversations on things that may not be represented in the mainstream media.
Okay, great. Thank you, everyone. So we're going to delve a little bit deeper with the different mediums of expression we have on the panel. So give me 1 second. A moment of patience, please, everyone. It should fire up. Okay, so we're going to start actually with Mariam. So I wanted to ask you, how does Summer, an online publication, we heard a little bit about how you structure your each issue, how do you actually go about assembling it?
Okay, well, the issues, I mean, the articles themselves come sort of through our there's an email that you can send if you want to submit an article. And so we'll go through and see, the collective will go through and see what submissions we've already received. And sometimes there's already a thematic thing that we can connect them together. So some of the issues, you know, the migration one, for example, we solicited a few because we saw a theme kind of coming about. And so part of it is just collecting, and then we make a decision on which ones we're going to keep. And then based on that, we work with the writer themselves. And the difference between Samar and, say, an academic journal is that Samar is very... you know, the language is more informal. It's not. There isn't academic jargon. So we work with the writer to basically make the piece accessible to a general audience. And then after we've and then we'll usually do a couple rounds of copy editing. So we'll meet and we do it all online actually because we're sort of based everywhere now. So and then we go through and the launch itself. It takes probably 2 to 3 days before we launch to just do the aggressive copy editing process. And then we launch it online. And we have somebody who works sort of behind the scenes to manage the infrastructure of the website. So.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mariam. We're going to move on to blogging with Abhi. We're going to put up a blog post that CPM Mutiny did as part of the coverage of the 2008 elections. And we're just going to give you guys a second to scroll through and read a little of it. At your own pace.
It's kind of embarrassing. I've never had anyone actually read something I've written while I've been in the room. You know, it's like
I was considering having you read some of it. I thought, no, let's experience it as a blog. Okay, so Abhi, how did CPM Mutiny's coverage of the national conventions and the elections, and I know you did a lot of pieces around it, how did it help add to the understanding of the South Asian participation in the conventions and the elections as a whole?
So one of my biggest concerns, based back in 2004, is that maybe we don't have as many South Asian people voting or participating because they feel it's not about them, you know? And we really didn't see a lot of stories that spoke to any issues or any people involved with the 2004 election. So part of going to this, and this was, you know, the first email that I ever sent out when we recruited the bloggers initially, before there was a site, when I'm saying, hey guys, I have an idea. One of the things I put down in there specifically was the 2004 Democratic National Convention. And I said, you know, wouldn't it be great if in 2008 they allowed bloggers and we could be there and, like, then we could get the real story, you know, the story that South Asian Americans might be interested in too. And so, you know, that's really was one of the basic motivations for me personally. I mean, everyone of the four or five people we started with, everyone had a different, you know, prime motivation. But what I wanted to do was show, even if just like this story, you know, you're at home watching on TV and you're like, oh my God, there's some Sikh guy with a turban. There are Sikh delegates? You know, I didn't know that, you know? And so that's the kind of story and the kind of access I wanted people to have in order to say, oh, well then there's no reason that I can't be a part of this and participate in whatever way I want to as well. So, you know, with the blog, we do something a little bit differently. There's a lot of, like, I don't even know if I consider myself an activist, because there's some great people here that are really, like, fighting the fight every day. I see myself in a way, and on our blog, as almost sort of a dating service between people and causes, okay? So we show a bunch of, like, really cool stuff that you could possibly get involved in, and we put it out in front of you, and then we hope that you make the leap and say, oh, I want to match myself up with that cause or with that issue, you know? And so that's the basic, that was the basic motivation behind why we started it.
So like a cause matrimony.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
I get what you're saying. Thanks so much, Avi. Now that we've talked about writing and publishing, let's move on to radio. This is a short clip from Radiosthan. The topic is brotherhood, and Tina is interviewing her brother about South Asian fraternities.
My father, Wu Shibata, started a fraternity in a hotel in San Antonio. I apologize. The backup is about to go up in a second.
That's funny.
I have no idea. I'm so sorry.
If you leave it on like, a few more minutes,
we
have more
people. Oh, yeah, we can dab to it while we're waiting. This is so fantastic.
Would you like me to introduce?
Yes.
So he very firmly rejects the notion that I could read Quran or I could pray 5 times and I, you know, use the white, you know, white magic, white light to come out of it. He's very specific that the only way out of it is for me to employ him and use black magic to counter it. And he says that if I pay him a small sum of $210, why if he writes me a million to his name, what he will do is he will assign a jinn to my case, and that apparently that jinn will then bring him free from my chains.
इस काम के ऊपर आपका बाजारी में जो आपका खर्चा आएगा $210 का
ठीक
ये आपको मेरे ही नाम के मुताबिक यूनस मसीह वल रहमत मसीह इसी नाम के मुताबिक बेटा उधर से वेस्टर्न यूनियन करवाने पड़ेंगे ये अभी जांच करवा के आओ उसका पिन नंबर बेटा मुझे बता दो मैं आपकी चीजें लेकर अमल फाइल लगा देता हूँ इंशाल्लाह ताला वो बदले खुदा अल्लाह की मेहरबानी से बेटा सिर्फ और सिर्फ 3 days 3 दिन के अंदर अंदर ये मसला आपका हो जाए.
Okay, it's a different clip, but I've actually listened to the show as well, and it's kind of about like magic and mysticism and things like that. Apologize for the technical error. So Tina, your show relies on interviews with academics, activists, and community members. How do you work with the community, and what has been the response to your show?
Well, we're kind of experiencing a shift in format actually lately, and this last clip was kind of a better example of where we want to go in the future. The first couple of shows we did feature a lot of academics, and they were great. I mean, I love Leela Gandhi, and she can talk a lot about her great-grandfather and the work that he's done, but we really wanted to get to people who were out there doing stuff, living their lives, and get those stories, the kind of quiet stories. So we've just, this clip that we heard right now was actually featuring a friend of my co-producer, Sameeps, and he has a blog as well, and so Chapati Mystery. And so we just wanted to experience what was going on in people's lives, just kind of capture a moment of, you know, you're having a problem, you want to call up someone to help you fix it? If you got $200 and you can send it by Western Union, send it over. So we wanted to get that perspective and have the audience come up with whatever they wanted to come up with.
And to give you a little bit of context, in the clip, he's cursed, but essentially it's like a mail order will free you of what's going on in the mystical sense if you just send us some money. And he describes that.
Right. So the show was called This Ghostbuster Stuff, and we called Pakistan, and we got the name of this black magician, as opposed to like a white magician, I guess. But, and so he was kind of assessing the problem and diagnosing it. Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Thank you, Tina. We're going to try to play another clip, and this one is going to be from Asia Pacific Forum. This is an excerpt of a segment about the Indian guest workers that we've talked about them in some of the other sessions, engaged in a quest for justice.
So I think it's, you know, like you were saying, it was kind of interesting that the organizing efforts were kind of cloaked in secrecy, and I think for a lot of people who aren't in the South, who aren't in the Gulf and not knowing what was happening, kind of hearing about the story at some point, it was just very inspirational and amazing to hear about your efforts there, and I congratulate you, Saket, on the efforts there. I wanted to ask, I know one of the workers' demands upon reaching Washington was to meet with the ambassador, Ranan Sen, the Indian ambassador here.
Yes.
And I just wanted to find out what the response has been from the ambassador so far and the Indian government in general.
The response has been pretty flaccid, unfortunately. The Indian workers, you know, took a very courageous step to come forward and expose a fairly powerful international trafficking racket that held them in forced labor.
Okay, great. Sorry, there's more, but we didn't want to take too long. Silky, Asia Pacific Forum is broadcast on WBAI, a Pacifica station. How does independent radio, like Pacifica Radio, provide an open medium for community-driven shows and shows that deal with topics that the mainstream media tend not to cover, which you've discussed?
I mean, I think, you know, I think Pacifica is a very good example of where it has worked for a lot of, I mean, there's, you know, Asia Pacific Forum exists in New York on WBAI, but at KPFA, and Berkeley is Apex Express, which is a similar show, a little different format, but, you know, attempting to do the same thing. And, you know, also at the LA station, KPFK, and the Houston station, KPFT, they have, like, Asian American type shows, and so, and they also have, like, other shows, you know, they have, like, the Latino show, or the whatever. So, I mean, you know, I think sometimes, I mean, I think at some point we'll talk a little bit about the identity piece, but, like, I think that, you know, it's really great that these five flagship Pacifica stations exist, but the fact is there's all these other community radio stations out there that are affiliated with Pacifica, but also not affiliated with Pacifica, and I know you're on WOW. I think it provides a lot of support, but I think it's, like, you know, a difficult thing to deal with also. I mean, I think community radio stations have their own set of problems, and, like, getting involved and just figuring out the boundaries of how much you're going to be involved. I mean, Pacifica's, like, going bankrupt, and it's just a total mess, and we don't even know if the show's going to be on, and, like, what's going to happen. And it's, like, always like that. So it's also just, like, okay, we're, you know, we're dealing with these community radio stations, you know, a lot of journalism's in trouble, you know, newspapers especially, but radio also. You know, one thing, and I don't know if we could share this, but our website has, like, we put everything up. Like, we have a podcast. We have a relationship with the radio station. We do our radio show from there. But we have our other piece, which is our own website, and we put up our own podcast. We put up, like, each segment on separately so people can listen to it on the website. And I think that's really, like, you know, say, like, WBAI just, like, goes under or something, like, you know, we just need a space in order to, like, record, and I think we'll keep going. And I think that's just, I mean, this is really about the show, and I think the station and supporting the station is really important, but, like, you know, we've, because of the complications, we've really had to really be like, okay, this is what we're doing too, you know? So I don't know if that's a good answer. But.
Yeah, that's great. I'd like to end with just another question to everyone in the panel. How does the work that you do in community-driven media create the social change that you envision? All of you kind of talked about why you started doing what you did. So how do you see that kind of coming into fruition through the work that you do? And let's start with Marian.
I think with Samara and with these other media, I think it provides a platform for example, the writers themselves don't have to necessarily be academics or journalists. These are anybody. I mean, any of you can submit an article to us and have your voice heard. And what we've been trying to do is make it more interactive. We have a discussion sort of. It's not as interactive as a blog would be, but we're trying to sort of facilitate some sort of dialogue. And because there's a lot of diversity of debate, whether or not, I remember the election issue, we did a thematic one on Obama, and we had somebody from South Asians for Obama do a piece, and just debate whether or not he represents, a progressive agenda necessarily, or Bobby Jindal, all these different sort of, not everybody has the same perspective. So it's just sort of a way of, I think, fostering dialogue and discussion and constructive debate. So I think for me, it's just a platform. I think that eventually these kinds of debates will lead to sort of substantive change.
I don't totally remember the exact question, but in terms of, I think we are just like very clear about like all of us are very politically driven people who are part of the collective, and we're just like, okay, we're gonna cover the stories we wanna cover, and we're gonna cover them the way we want to. And that's what's really great about being on BAI, is that like that's how things are done there. And so we're really lucky to have that platform. But really it's like we wanna foster dialogue, we wanna bring in voices that aren't heard as much, but it's the background of, I work as a full time organizer on detention issues. Other people work as like editors or our academics or work as organizers as well, and one person's actually a reporter, so it's interesting because we've really we have like a lot of different backgrounds, but really like we're all coming from, it's really we all try to be like, when we're considering new collective members, we're thinking about how like being on the same page about things. And it doesn't always happen, but it's so crucial for us to have room for that.
I guess our goal for Radiothon was that we could reach non-traditional listeners. So maybe they wouldn't necessarily be students or organizers or activists or academics. They might be just working professionals or the guy at the grocery store, or your grandfather. So that's the demographic we were hoping to reach and try to get them in. And we kind of have an educational goal as well. So we did a show on Trinidad, on basically what's going on there, culture and a little bit of race politics in Trinidad. We did a show on dreaming, and we wanted to look at political aspirations and dreams. So we're just hoping that people will, again, sort of start talking about things, and that people that wouldn't normally be exposed to some of these issues and themes would be.
I guess with our forum, even like just the very name of our forum, right? When you think of mutiny, most mutinies, every single member of the mutiny sort of has their own agenda. Okay, so because of that, we aren't trying to have a certain focus that, hey, with this community, we're trying to do this action. Instead, we're trying to build a community such that they can have, through an online presence, a wider reach. Okay, so for example, whenever I get an email from someone, say like in Iowa, that says, hey, I'm South Asian and I live in Iowa, and there's like absolutely no way I can get involved because there's so few, Indians or Pakistanis or whatever here, but I love reading the site because I feel connected, and I know that even though I can't do something here in my immediate community, through this forum or through other forums, I can go out there and I can still have an impact. So that sort of virtual community, is a great way to actually see action. As an example, even though we've been running the blog 5 years, I still haven't even met a couple of the original founders. Okay, so that's how we do a lot of it, just through the internet. We don't really need to build a physical, in front of the other relationship. We can do it all virtually, and it does work. I feel when you put something out there, you might not be able to take action on that, but you hear back that, oh, with that piece of information, somebody else was able to take action with that information. So.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for sharing. I'd like to now open it up to questions from the audience. So let me start with Amreen. Yeah, you know what? That's probably a good idea.
Thank you so much for all your perspectives. I think for organizations, you guys are providing really interesting models for how they can sort of guide their own media coverage by creating it. I'm curious how much time your ventures take out of your schedules and what the business model is. Like, are all the people that are affiliated with your organization just doing this as a hobby? Does anyone do this full time? Just to get a sense of how much resource it would require for an organization to take something like that on.
Does anybody feel like they have a particular?
Well, I was actually like, because I think this was a part of one of your questions, and I had like planned on it, but we have like a collective application, like we have a process to apply to be a part of the collective, and we make it very clear like the duties of the collective. But I mean, we see that it being like a 10 to 12 hour commitment a month, including the meeting and one show. But, you know, like last summer, like all these people traveled and I did like 3 shows 1 month and I was probably spending 30 hours on it in the month. And, you know, if you're doing more produced pieces, it takes more time. At this point, we don't have any funding to have anybody on. Like, everybody does it as a hobby, or hobby, well, whatever, like our work. It's really important to us. But we've thought about that. I mean, it's something like we're like, oh, what if we syndicate? What if we get more money? But that's another piece of work, and we're actually working on that. So that's like in addition to the 10 to 12 hours a month, just getting the show together, getting 3 segments together, and actually doing the show and then going to the meeting is. And sometimes it's like a little bit more than that, but I'd say 12 hours a month. And like thinking about it that way is really important, especially people who do activist work and their jobs and, you know, maybe have families or whatever else. Like, really thinking about it in terms of hourly or like a way to think about it, I think is, in terms of if you guys really want to do this, like, it's been helpful for me.
So as far as business model for our blog, you can make money off of blogs, definitely. I mean, if we put ads on our blog, or if we ask for VC money, I have no doubt we could probably pull in $500,000 just in VC money. However, for now, idealist that I am, I'm kind of doing it. We're doing a nonprofit, and what we do is we hold a pledge drive, just like NPR does, and they pay for all our server costs. That way, you know, the readers donate $5 each to keep it going. So the alternative, of course, would be if I put ads on the site, and then we could probably fund ourselves and make a profit. But I just don't feel like doing that right now, because I feel that people that come to a blog, especially a blog like ours, you know, come there for specific information or just to be inspired, and I just have a problem right now with putting ads on the site for that reason. And as far as time, when I was a grad student, of course, I had a flexible schedule, and I would pump in a lot of hours. So on top of writing a doctoral dissertation, I'd spend maybe like 6 to 8 hours a day on it. Now I have a full-time job with the federal government, so I don't have the time. I have to do it on my off hours, and I still put in probably like, I don't know, 2 to 3 hours a day on some days, and sometimes I take the weekend off or a week off. So, but the good part about it is that we don't have editors. Okay, we are each our own editor, which is part of the reason we're very selective. There's a lot of great writers out there, a lot of great writers in the South Asian community, but it's very, very difficult to find what we consider super do-it-all type bloggers that can write well, edit well, understand the technology well, have a good command of the voice. Because blogging's not like writing. You could be a best-selling author, or you could be a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and that doesn't necessarily mean you would be a good blogger, because it's a very different thing. So, but because of that, if we select people that can self-edit, self-run, there's not a lot of organization time. Like I said, I haven't even met some of the people I started it with 5 years ago. So,
can I have actually Lavanya, if you'd like to? You might want to use the mic just to.
What kind of stories that you do get the most feedback or readership or comments?
Anything in particular?
That's an easy one for me to answer. It's kind of, everyone's going to laugh, but the number one type of story that gets the most feedback, the most interest, are any stories relating to dating or marriage in the South Asian community. So. I mean, by far, if you look at the stats on our website and you're like, oh my God, so many people are visiting that one post, what is it? And you click on the link and sure enough, it's a post about dating or marriage and something like that. So,
could you talk a little bit about what you think that says?
Yeah, I mean, I think it just goes to show you that, you know, even though we're all like, you know, diehard after our cause, right? There's this one little neuroses that we all have in this community that's like, oh yeah, I'm totally gonna go to that activist meetup. Oh, maybe there's a cute girl or guy. And so that comes through in the way people show interest in the stories we write about. So.
Reinforcing the matrimonial meme here.
Which ones don't do well? You know, it's funny. Sometimes the ones that I'm the most passionate about, I'm like, oh my God, this, how, you got to know about this. Maybe some, like, I'm a political junkie, right? So if there's some real, like, nuance, oh, here's the political data that came out of this. For example, I was sitting in the session earlier with the one that Taz was in about the new SALT stats that came out for voting. Mm-hmm. And I looked at the data and, you know, I guess my engineering background kicked in, and some of the data I think is skewed. And so automatically my mind is thinking, no, I think there's a bias in this data and I want to write about it. Okay? Now I know from experience that if I write about that, even though I think it's important, it's probably going to get very few comments and not many people are going to be interested in it. So.
I think for us, just really quickly, is it's really like who you're interviewing. It's like if the interviewer is good, like people get into it. Like I was interviewing somebody about military spending in the Asia region, and it was like, you know, that could be really boring to a lot of people, but it was a great interview because he was just really on. And I think, you know, like for us, it's like the pre-interview process is really important. Yeah, if you have, like, a bad interview, it's just like, okay, this person's again, like, no.
I just have a quick follow-up, just in terms of how you define interest. I mean, is it the number of contacts? Because I can imagine certain topics, or is it click-through?
For us, and it might be different for you guys, for me, there's three ways. A, there's number of comments. Okay, B, there's the number of mainstream media or other blogs that link to you. Because, you know, we'll get cited occasionally by, you know, BBC or Washington Post or New York Times. So that's the second way. And the third way is, you know, word of mouth. If people write in, they don't want to comment because they're not a typical commenter. Because, you know, there's this whole, some people associate a stigma with blogs and commenting, you know, which is something, you know, if you go back 5 years, when we started CP Mutiny, right, people are like, oh, blogs, so are you write a diary about your day? You know, and now you see the same thing with Twitter. They're like, oh, Twitter, you know. God, I'd rather die than do Twitter. But, you know, it's all about riding the wave to your benefit. So just because you Twitter doesn't mean you're going to be like, oh, I stopped by Starbucks right now. There's a powerful way to use it, you know, so.
So you're a Twitter user, I see.
I do the CP Muni Twitter account right now, so.
Hey, I think there's something with the question.
Hi. I've been an activist for a good number of years, and the two largest campaigns that I've done, the media has been an integral part of it and has really contributed to sort of not jump-starting it, but taking it to that next level, which really gives people the access to come in and not only individuals to participate, but also higher-level folks that you're trying to get the attention of, like legislators. And so I really appreciate the kind of work that you guys are doing and spending so much of your, you know, resources, your personal resources and energy towards. My question was for organizations or individuals that have causes that they're passionate about or want to connect with the larger, you know, the newer technologies, what are the ways that you guys sort of get the word out there that, you know, that you're out there, right? Like, so with blogs and with Twitter, how do you inform people who don't already know about you? So one way I've seen is, you know, I've seen listservs and posting on listservs, like we're doing a story on this and that. But aside from that, I mean, a lot of the, it seems very self-contained. So I'm trying to figure out how you get people who are not already into blogging or to come and see your blog, or how do you let people know who might not otherwise blog, but now, or read blogs, but are, would, because they're interested in the kinds of issues that you guys cover.
Okay, so do you want to start?
Actually, can we pump this one to Tina? Your show is actually kind of starting out. Can you talk a little bit about the strategy that you've used to bring awareness around what you're doing?
Well, we have been posting things on Facebook to try to direct traffic in. And since we're just starting out, we're actually hoping to get linked to other websites. So that's probably the easiest way to get traffic towards you. And then, again, listservs, posting on as many listservs as possible, word of mouth. I don't know. That's what we're doing.
Oh, pretty much the same. We also have a Facebook page and also a listserv and an outreach sort of database. So we have names of organizations in the South Asian community that we try to outreach to every time we launch an issue, which is every, 4 months or so.
Okay, so there's really two aspects to your question. One is if you're an organization, okay, that maybe doesn't have a blog or something, how do you get your organization maybe blogged or maybe disseminated via the web some way, okay? So the best way is that most bloggers I know, including myself, do not read press releases at all, okay? We just, if I get a press release, it just goes to my junk mailbox pretty much, okay? So if you want to get your organization noticed, do not send a press release. Instead, send a personal note of why you believe in the cause, because a lot of bloggers that I know if they get excited by what you describe, they will want to write about it. However, also think of them, okay? So if I'm writing about something, in order for me to disseminate that information, it would make my job a lot easier if you have pictures, if you have a video, if you have your own website where you document something. Because I'm trying to, by putting it on my blog, I'm trying to disseminate it as far and wide as possible. So you have to provide me the weapons to do so, okay? The second half of your question, how do we advertise? We advertise in two ways, in the sense that we make it easy. At the bottom of all of our posts, we put a one button so that you can upload it to Facebook, one button so that you can email it to your friend, okay? And then word of mouth, because I think the best way to advertise your site is word of mouth. If you have a friend whose opinion you value or trust, and you know that they're into the right things that you would like to be into, you are going to trust them if they say, oh, I've been reading this new site, or I've been listening to this new radio program. I think you should check it out because you'll like it. So the strategy there is easy. Just be quality and be consistent. It has to do with your frequency. I get asked to link to a lot of blogs that only write once a month. Well, sorry, I'm not going to link to you, because if people click on that blog and they see no updates in the last month, then I lose my credibility because I've suggested to them. So I will never suggest something to someone that I don't myself believe in. So that way it builds up credibility as well that way.
I have a question for the folks that do radio. Is there any sort of movement with working with other cities to get some South Asian media on those radio stations, or moving to TV as well to reach out populations that on a time that everyone can watch, on a channel that everyone gets, so that we're reaching more people?
Well, I mean, for us, we're actually trying to, like, maybe syndicate and so get our show out there more, but we also, like, talk to the folks at Apex Express and Berkeley and some other, I talked to Sameet before they started Radio Stan. We're definitely, like, we've been a resource to folks a lot, but there isn't, like, there's not, like, a movement or anything like that, but, yeah.
There's a more follow-up question to that, too, is there's so many different forms of media, especially now that are more progressive, and then there's the traditional ones that a lot of people make, or the older generation make, so epic media, print media, that they get from the local Indian stores or Pakistani stores that they pick up, and it'd be great to see some more different types of stories in those papers. Not just the basics, what's going on in India, talks about that at home, but also what's going on here, what are some of the activists doing here, and highlighting even the work that you all are doing to reach maybe a younger population or older population, whatever it is. It'd just be nice to see it in other forms of media that reaches a larger audience. But I mean,
like India Abroad or something like that. Yeah, no, I think that's a really important point, and I think there needs to be. One thing that was one of the questions on here was about sort of, I guess it was like the identity-based piece. And I think it's interesting, we had somebody who like applied for the collective, and we were like doing the interview process, might be too much information, but we were doing the interview process, and she was like, so we were like, oh, like, why are you excited about Asia Pacific Forum? She's like, you know, it's cool, but I don't know. Like, I think it's really weird that you have this, like, identity-based, like, medium. And we were all just like, okay, yeah, your interview's going really great. But, I mean, then I, you know, I came back and I was like, you know, for us, it's not about that. For us, it's about these stories and what's happening in Asian America, what's happening in Asia. It's not like, it's not about our identity. Like, yes, we're interested in these stories, but I mean, so I think there's like a fine line there between like the ethnic media, which is so crucial and so important, and like we see ourselves as ethnic media, but it's not like, oh, we're here to like claim some Asian American identity, which also just doesn't really make sense. So we're trying to like work within the parameters that we've been given. But I do think communication with other outlets, and I think some people have, and I think, you know, one of our collective members is a reporter, and he does a lot of like, he has a blog about you know, he's Filipino, and so he does, you know, his blog is, I think, about, like, what's going on in the Philippines, but Filipino America, too, so it's, like, you know, it's, I mean, so we have those connections, but they need to be made more, and I appreciate you saying that.
The TV, the point about TV was really interesting. I don't know what to say about that, but in terms of video, I have seen a kind of renaissance in the number of filmmakers and actors and stuff that are out there. Although I feel like it is kind of isolated in this film festival circuit, and only once in a while will I get to see something that I've seen at a film festival on PBS or on TV. So I don't know. We need some connections.
My mother is a journalist, and her tie, it was SAJA, which is the South Asian Journalists Association. And it's so great to be sitting here. I can't wait to go back to my job, because it's a whole new movement that probably just came up in the last 5 or 10 years, which is sort of why I'm asking about the different modes of communication, because in her life, which is basically all of our parents, it was TV and ethnic media. And so I was just sort of trying to see how we're still reaching out to that population. That's sort of the reason for my question. So thank you.
Do you guys, are your shows available on iTunes,
podcasts,
studio, all that stuff?
Yes. They are. So, like, I'm just going to plug AsiaPacificForum.org. Definitely check it out. And that you can listen to it from the website, but you can also, like, subscribe to the podcast. We have a Facebook page, whatever.
Yeah. We're at radiostan.com, so you can download on iTunes, subscribe.
That's a good point. The longer you blog, it's a vicious cycle. The more you blog, okay, the more readers you get if you're decent, right? The more readers you get, the more pressure you feel to consistently put out a good product. And that cycle just takes off until some people have nervous breakdowns, okay? Luckily, I've managed to avoid that. But it's, I mean, you bring up a point that that everyone associated with our site is definitely cognizant of. I mean, we feel like, you know, we are honored that people read us, and so we feel like we have to always do our best, you know? And, you know, a lot of times, like, I'll want to write about an issue, like, for example, the stuff that's going on right now in Pakistan and the government, you know, and how it's going to affect the war against terror that we're not, we don't use that phrase anymore, I know. But a lot of times I do a double take. Should I really write about this? Because I know that there's going to be a segment of the population that's not going to agree with my view on this particular issue. And by the fact that I write about it, even though it's my opinion, the fact that a lot of people read this site, I think to myself, maybe I research a little bit more, maybe I have a little bit more confidence in what I'm going to say. So it is something that I'm sure with everyone on this panel, because they know people listen and care, we put more of an effort into researching topics and hopefully not taking an argument off in some wrong direction, you know?
Yeah, I have one question also. As I know, everybody knows the media play a big role for a social change, for bringing out every kind of issue. There is a radio, TV, and a virtual media, and print media. Especially, my problem is with the print media, print media, that most of them, newspapers especially, I'm from Pakistan, I read Urdu, but I cannot read Bengali or Hindi. I don't know what's going on with their ethnic print media. But in Pakistani newspaper, the most yellow journalism, that's newspaper are just made for making money. You pay them money, they put their news or their photographs. But they are not putting any kind of social issue or what's going on with the community. They are not going to put that kind of issue. Because nowadays, people who can grow up here, they are getting education here, they understand all the law-ups and things like that. I don't understand. Also, most of our communities are still uneducated working class people who are older people living there. They read their newspapers. And how we can solve that problem instead of giving them that kind of newspaper, if there could be any non-profit organization who can put a clear that newspaper without any advertising making money, because I don't understand, maybe I understand wrong, Tina, that she was talking, they find out about a spiritual man in Pakistan, and he solved the problem. I don't know how, did they send the money or not, because I came late. But most of in Pakistan newspapers, there are 10 advertisements of half pages which you give it the $1,000 and then they publish it. They are ripping off our people. People are so, working class people are simple. Everybody, they have a problem, they bring our problem, they have other problems. So they are trapped by those people. And they are sending their hard working money to those people if they cannot do anything. Instead of doing that kind of advertisement, they can put issue that how you could be united and fight together to for those issues. How we can solve this print media problem.
So I think maybe kind of to go along with what you said, to think about how we've opened up new audiences, as some people have outlined, in different media than we're used to outside of things like newspapers that have kind of been around for a long time and have been kind of owned by a certain generation. How can we, now that we've explored these new media and built all these new audiences, how can we go back and open this up to the first generation, to people who are not being reached by, you know, the internet as well, or things like that? Like, what do you think about strategies that activists can take?
I think it's, I mean, this is a hard question to answer, I have to say, but I think it's part of it is what you're covering, and it's like who the community is. Like, one of the things we recently did was we had Henry Chang, he's this author who writes about Chinatown, and, you know, his books are just kind of fun reads that are like mysteries, and we actually had two of our collective members walk through Chinatown with him, and he started telling stories about, you know, growing up in Chinatown and what that experience was like, and, you know, so we have stories like that, but then we also, like, cover stories from CAV, which is a lot of Chinese tenant organizing in New York. And I think, you know, having those relationships, I mean, I think for us, like when we think about news stories, we think not just international, not just Asia, but we're thinking national, but also local, like what's going on in New York, and also locally in other places. And I think that brings folks in. I mean, I think that that's a really good way to, like, once we're in the community, once we're, like, communicating with them, I think that kind of disperses. And so that's been a way we've really, I mean, I think it's just the community work. I mean, I think it's hard to be like, oh, we're going to get our, like, aunties and uncles, like, listening to our show or whatever. That's hard. That's really hard. But, I mean, if you're working with the community, it gets out there more.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, you brought up a lot of good points, and it's very actually similar to what's happening in China right now, right? In China, they ban all the blogs and such so that you have to pay attention to what the state media produces, right? And so we're kind of running into a similar problem, but not quite the same. Here, the problem isn't that the government is censoring anything. You have access to everything. It's just that there's a little bit of a technology gap in that, you know, a lot of people in the older community, it takes a while to learn a new technology. I finally got my mom to check my email I sent her every day. You know, first it was every week, and then maybe a couple times a week. So now she can text me. Okay. So part of it is that a lot of the people that read our website, they'll tell me, hey, that article, I sent that to my mom or I sent that to my dad. Okay, and then pretty soon, after they get enough of those articles, then they tell me, oh yeah, my dad or my mom reads your site now. Okay, so that, it has to start, partly each of the younger generation in this room has to take an active step in educating the older generation and showing them that it's not this thing you should be afraid of. It's a very simple to use technology if I can walk you through it. And then as a few members of the older generation learns that, they can show the peers their same age, hey, I was able to learn. I'm not too old to learn. You, friend of mine, you can learn too. You know, so it spreads that way. And you're right when you said that if you look at a lot of, you know, because I read articles, the English articles that are in Pakistani newspapers or in Indian newspapers, and the vast majority of the time, well, more often than not, I'm rolling my eyes at obvious bias or untruths or misquotes or something. And that is where, you know, all this media here is basically nonprofit. And so we have no profit. You know, occasionally someone will write in and say, oh God, you're so biased. You're just trying to, you know, raise money or get more readers to come to your website. And I think to myself, why? We don't make a single penny off of anything. So why do I care if one person comes to my website or 10,000? I have no reason to lie or to spread false information, right? And so that's the benefit of this kind of not-for-profit media. But the trick, like you're saying, is to get your peers turned on to that and to educate them that these resources exist. You just need to search them out and get over that little technological barrier.
I guess what I heard in Jada's question, Natasha's question was not so much kind of making our parents or the generations or technologically savvy to access your spaces you created, but if I've heard it, which I thought was a really, for me, important question, is how to go back and use these sort of traditional media sites, which are still more valuable to create a critical role, but for us to sort of, because in some ways when you sort of create these alternative sites, there's almost like the space where, okay, this is where we're going to talk about the progressive issue that we care about, and then we sort of abandon these spaces, which, you know, in some ways, I think Radio Sun's mission was to kind of reach out to this population that wouldn't necessarily come to the summit, right? And so I think that's a really important issue in terms of mass-based organizing and movement building, because, you know, you do have to kind of look back into and try to bring in those goals. So the only thing I'll share with just the Bangla class is that, you know, there are individuals, it's not a monolith, and so there are a lot of individuals who actually share a political passion. They actually came to the United States, you know, fleeing persecution, so they share and, like, identify with the issues. It's maybe perhaps, you know, for those of us who may speak the language, like, I don't write in Bengali. Mm-hmm. So recently it was very funny, it's like I had given a talk in Bengali, but I wrote it out phonetically in English. And so at the end, the reporter said, you know, give me the speech. And I was like so embarrassed. I was like, oh God, I'm like looking to see my English writing. And then he took it, and I was sort of like mortified what he was going to do with it.
And it turned out he took it, he wrote it in Bengali. He put my name to it. And while there is a little bit of, you know, credibility issue, like, well, he just took my name and I don't know, but I think that feed information provided. And I do think that, you know, they will print it, at least in terms of, I can't speak to about Bangladesh Press, but definitely the Bangladeshi Press will do that. You give them pictures. And because they want to fill up their space, right, mm-hmm. too. And so they will print it. I think we just have to be a little bit more open to inserting ourselves into those spaces. It's not always positive. Sometimes you're misquoted and it's annoying. But I think, you know, we're keeping with it. And I wouldn't necessarily ban those spaces, but I think that this panel is really excellent. And I just wanted to thank each of you for taking 6 to 8 hours. I don't know when you find it, in addition to doing everything.
I think one thing, I mean, just coming from the perspective, and I really appreciate what both of you guys have said, and like coming from the perspective of an organizer, I worked for an organizer for years in Texas, and us working with the ethnic press there was like the most valuable thing. I was doing work with immigrant rights communities, but it wasn't South Asian, it was Latino, Chicano very much as well, but working with the ethnic press was so valuable. So I think, you know, for us, it's hard to like, I don't know, hard to totally make that sense of that relationship, but I mean, I think as organizers, as activists, like we, like, you know, that's a crucial point of, you know, getting out there, like what, you know, like it is very valuable, and I think it's important relationships have been built with community organizers and ethnic press all around the country, so, mm-hmm. you know.
And I would add, I think a big part of what I think you're describing is that the movement building can't happen in a silo that only includes like people of a certain age group or people of a certain proficiency. And I think that in terms of, you know, the work that you can do as an organization is to try to characterize what you're doing in a way that people can understand. If you're gonna use esoteric terms that only, you know, a fellow social justice activist would understand, then yeah, you won't get ethnic press and you don't deserve it because you need to be able to put it like them. You need to be able to put it. You shouldn't, because you need to be able to put it into terms that their readers are going to identify with. And I think that that's something that every single person has said. When you have to know who your audience is and you have to know who their audiences are. Media is so interrelated. Causes are interrelated, and if you can't put it into language that does that, then you know, you're going to have to face the limitations of that. And I think we've kind of heard that from many different places. I actually saw another hand.
Sorry, so it's the question that you mentioned Twitter, and I think it's really interesting the past 2 or 3 years how much the internet has changed. The internet itself, when it came to really public access, brought change, and now even more so when it comes to putting out your voice or expression. Now, you know, blogs and now Twitter and then Facebook itself is opened up way more than just making friends. Now there's pages and connections. And also things like on the other side is happening in, you know, outside the virtual world, which is, you know, the economy going down, newspapers just tanking across the country, and a lot of them going virtual. But even the ones going virtual are still losing money. And I mean, it could be a lot of things, but I really want to ask all of you, what do you see the future of the internet going? It seems like it's almost going in almost like a socialist way, where it's becoming access to news and media is becoming accessible to everyone. And there could be some dangers there, as in, obviously, things like misquotations, rumors, whatever gossip can be spread, and untrue things that might not be checked by the same not having editing. But also you have things like Wikipedia, where it's actually quite relevant because people are so in wondering where you see media going in the future because of virtual reality and how that's going to relate to a shift in getting engaged in the traditional media.
Actually, can I put this to Mariam? I know that Summer used to be, like a physical publication, and y'all made the decision to go online. So maybe could you speak to a little bit of like what led you to that decision, what that's opened up, and what that might mean for the future?
Sure. So Samar's been around for a while. It started in the aftermath of the Babri Masjid demolition in 92. So it basically started out print, and then I think because it's volunteer and the cost of doing a print publication and the time involved, I wasn't there when they made that transition, but the online format has really made it feasible for it to be fully voluntary. And we don't fund, we've thought about fundraising, but that opens up another level of just time commitment and the strain of that. So the new media and the internet has really been a way for us to also just be, because it's not a blog in the sense that, I mean, we do edit, we do sort of do the fact checking, we do, but it is responsive. Like when the Bombay blast happened, we were able to put together, a few pieces right away within a few weeks of that happening. Or the summer of 06 when Lebanon was being bombed, we were able to draw upon like our, activist friends and people who are knowledgeable about what's going on to put an emergency issue out. So that format of it's responsive. It's not as immediate real time as a blog would be, but it's so it has a little bit more of the thought behind how to piece, get these different perspectives and piece it together in terms of a thematic. But cost wise, I think that's probably one of the major, because print has its own value, but it's too difficult, I think, in terms of sustainability.
Blogs kind of are helping kill traditional media, right? And it's sort of a double-edged thing in that we often, as bloggers, rail against traditional media, but we need traditional media because a lot of our stuff is based on them, right? So this fundamental problem I see is that people no longer correctly see that information is currency. Okay, information should not be free, because if information is free, then the quality of that information will degrade. So if you think about traditional media right now, every single newspaper is going down in revenues, losing subscribers, this, that, and the other thing, except for one. So does anyone remember what the one newspaper that they're... Well, I was actually thinking NPR. Their listenership went up by like 10% in the last few years. So everyone else is struggling, and they're going up. But wait a minute, how is NPR's model different? They are asking people for money. So people actually pay them, right? And people like the quality. It's really high quality what you learn. I think they did a survey that said that back in the 2006 or 4 election cycle, the most educated voters were the ones that listened to NPR. Okay? So the first thing we got to do is recalibrate people's understanding that information is currency, and if you want the best information, you have to pay for it. They do this already in the business world. If you want Investors Business Daily, you pay for it, and you pay a lot. You pay like a $500 a year subscription. And I think eventually you're going to see the point where mainstream media is degraded so much that people are going to say, stop, all right, we'll pay, because this is just crap, And I think blogs will support that, because blogs need that information too, so.
Maybe NPR's like listenership is going up, but like they do get corporate funding, and okay, which does guide what they're putting out there, which is very different from other community radio stations. And also they canceled two of their shows, Day to Day, which was a crappy show anyways, but News and Notes, which it was their one African American show. So they are also hurting, and it's, it's a little more complicated than that, I think, but yeah.
Just one more thing, too. In terms of framing stories in any kind of media, and I'll speak for video and radio, there's the editing process changes the story, and kind of positions it in a certain way. So, I'm sure that most readers are not aware when they read something, they kind of take it at face value, but there's a framing process that goes through that. With documentaries, people kind of take it for face value, but there's very much a director's perspective. There's things being cut out and left out, and that can be a problem as well. So to just keep that kind of commentary in your mind going on when you're accessing media.
Hey, Shwali, would you like to go?
No, but we have to, being a part of a community radio station, we have to fundraise on the actual station, so they have pledge drives every, like NPR does, so, yeah.
So my question is, for those of you that had to make the choice of whether to do advertising or not, I understand some of the general objections to it. I wanted to learn a little bit more about what specific objections were for your group to decide.
For me, it's probably because I'm a stupid idealist, because I should be putting ads on there. It would make sense to. Yeah, I don't want people to think, oh, okay, well, they put ads, now they're making money, so maybe they're just trying to get more readership to their site, and so I don't have to believe what they say as much anymore.
So it's not the concern that it's actually going to corrupt the journalistic integrity of the perception of it?
I guess it's my self-perception, okay. You know, like, I know what I'm going to write. It's always right. Going to have integrity regardless of whether there's ads or not. But then there's this part of me that thinks to myself, well, you know, I have a job. I have a full-time job. I don't really need that money. So, you know, leave it off. No, nobody makes any money on our blog. It's all a pledge drive. So.
We don't have ads. The reasoning behind it. As a collective, we haven't actually discussed it. It hasn't come up, but we've thought about fundraising through foundations or just grant writing, but not, and I guess personally, because it's something that we never talked about as a group, but I think personally it is sort of the same, like I have a perception of if there's an ad on a site, there's sort of another ulterior motive, maybe in another agenda. So it could compromise the perception of integrity on the site.
We're a nonprofit. We can't. Yeah. We can't have that.
We're not allowed.
Yeah. but we have fundraised, and we have like we've gotten foundation money to get like equipment and stuff like that.
Okay, great. Well, we have actually run out of time. It's been a lot of great questions. Thank you so much. I'd like to thank all of the panelists, Mariam Saifi, Silky Shah, Tina Paga Yakota, and Abhi Tripathi. And they're going to be around, so please keep asking them questions.
Can I make some suggestions? If people want to do their own radio,
sure. Let's do that really quickly.
Yeah, just some things to check out is transom.org. It's TRANSOM.org is a great resource. Like, you can find all this information about how to make your own podcast or your own radio. If you're in New York, People's Production House has trainings. If you're in the Bay, KPFA has an apprenticeship program. Also, I suggest if you really want to get into radio, volunteer at your local station. But I love doing radio. It's a lot of fun, and I think everybody should do it. So.
Great. Thank you, everyone.